Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue with our exposition of the book of Genesis. We are currently in Genesis chapter 30, just about ready to enter Genesis 31 and Jacob's flight from Laban. God has blessed Jacob with a family, but God has also blessed Jacob economically during his now stay of 14 years in Paddan Aram. Jacob has worked off his price for his two brides, Rachel and Leah, 7 years each, 14 total. He's now asking Laban for his release from his father-in-law. That release includes Laban granting Jacob the right to leave in peace with Rachel and Leah and all their children. From Jacob's request, the tone of it, we gather that just gathering up everybody and everything he owned was not as simple as just jetting out of town. He naturally feels to get Laban's acknowledgment that his, Jacob's, debt is, as it were, paid in full, and all is free, and that paves the way for him to go. In verses 27 and 28 of chapter 30, though Jacob has fulfilled his part of the bargain, Laban appeals to Jacob not to leave for his homeland back in Cana, but to stick around. That's not because Laban loved Jacob. That's because Laban claims he has divined through ritual means that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Now, here's a commentary note that I will share about this divining. There is no mention of what type of divination Laban used, but all divination, I'm still quoting, was later forbidden under the law. We're not down to the time of the law of Moses by any stretch. Divination assumed, that is the practice, that there was knowledge to be gained about activities and motives of the gods through the use of various indicators, such as entrails of sacrificed animals. Divination operated in a worldview that was contrary to the Bible. But get this, I agree with this note. Nevertheless, God occasionally chooses to use such methods, as the Bethlehem Star attests. The same way when God directed the Babylonians against Jerusalem, this is my comment, instead of elsewhere, when Nebuchadnezzar used divination at the crossroads. So Laban, wanting to keep Jacob around to enhance his business, he felt he had a guy who had God's blessing upon him. Laban says to Jacob, "Name your wages, I will pay them." Well, in verse 29, Jacob says, "You know yourself how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me. For you had little before I came. It is increased to a multitude. The Lord has blessed you wherever I have turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?" So Laban says, verse 31, "So what shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock. Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted and every black one among the lambs, and the spotted and the speckled among the goats. These will be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. Everyone that is not speckled or spotted among the goats and the black among the lambs, if found with me, will be considered stolen. And Laban said, Good, it's a good deal. Let it be according to your word. Jacob had an idea then which did not involve financial compensation, but it involved his continued management of Laban's flock with one big tweak in their agreement. What he wanted Laban to agree to was simply this. Jacob would go through all Laban's flocks and set aside for himself every speckled and spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, and every spotted and speckled goat. They will be my wages. That way things would be kept on the up-and-up between he and Laban. They could always know whose flocks were whose. Typically, sheep were all white, the goats were all black. So Jacob was not making a piggish request. Well, to that deal, Laban assented. But it appears that on the very day, Laban again pulls a fast one on Jacob. It seems he quickly separated all the male goats that were streaked and spotted, and the speckled and spotted female goats, all that had white on them, and all the dark-colored lambs, and placed them in the care of his sons. Verse 36, moving quickly, the cunning Laban, quote, put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Jacob's flocks. In verses 37 to 40, and I think you'll be interested in this, Jacob's old ways reappear. The sanctifying process, the Spirit of God works in his people. Everything doesn't flip all at once. Jacob had gotten a bellyful of Laban's cunning and deceitful ways, but now we find Jacob falling back on some of his old ways. He fell back on a folklore tradition about breeding. Jacob figures to outwit Laban. He knows the stunt his father-in-law has pulled to cheat him. So he tries, Jacob that is, tries his hand at selective breeding. He does this with the use of fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees. He made, we read, in verses 37 through 40, white strips on them. He did this by peeling the bark and exposing the inner wood of branches. Then what does he do? He places the peeled branches in front of all the watering troughs. Why do you do that? Well, so that when the flocks came, or so he thought, to drink, they would mate there when they were in heat. The idea was, by this folklore means, to influence their genetics, producing for Jacob young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. Well, it happened as Jacob hoped, but it didn't happen because of the validity of his superstition. It happened because of the power of divine intervention. And that power of divine intervention we know he came to recognize. We'll see it clearly and emphatically in chapter 31, verse 9. Here's the point. God was with Jacob. God was blessing him as promised. What we have here is literary dramatic irony. That's when we, the readers, see what the actor, Jacob, in this case, seems blind to at the moment. You know, folks, like so many contemporary believers who like to view themselves as smart, and they credit their successes in their ventures to the fact that they are savvy, they are hardworking. They never grasp that the prosperity of their undertakings has far more to do with divine providence and divine favor than their own personal merits. And when that happens, the glory and grace of God is obscured. Also, our spiritual growth is stunted by our inability to see beyond ourselves to the real source of our success. Right here we see that Jacob is still a work in progress in the grace of God. Eventually, the good news is, he will get it and get it fully. But right now, he's still a man who is struggling with old habits. And here we see him involved not only in deceit, but some superstitious ideas. So in verses 41 and 42, he also tried selective breeding in the sense that he only allowed the stronger females in heat to water at those places where he places the peeled branches. The result was that the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. But this worked not because of his technique. This worked because of God's providence. So verse 43, in this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous despite Laban, and he came to own large flocks and male and female servants, and camels and donkeys. Now all of this, as we close chapter 30, is in accordance with the covenant that God made with Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. What we have here, and will continue to have through these narratives, is a testimony to his faithfulness to his promises. It's not just a matter of historical record, but the historical record is a matter of instruction and encouragement and an example for all of us. We're not Jacob's. We're not Abraham's. We're not Isaac's. But we're the heirs of all of that. And we have the same God. And the same God who protected them, who made promises to them, who provided for them, that same God is our God. And folks, what God promises, he will perform. But let's stop right there. Right there. Pause a minute. We must be sure that we understand accurately what God promises. We must be careful. We must beware of taking for promises what God hasn't promised. I notice a lot of people who are not just them, but particularly in charismatic and Pentecostal circles. They're always talking about faith in this and faith in that, and faith in promises that God has never made. They just think, because they manage to generate what they call faith, that God will do this or that, something that they want very much to happen. It may be God's will, it may not be God's will, but they put God's name on it, and that is very, very dangerous. Because when we do that, and we hang God's name on some promise that we have generated, then through misinterpretation, our God is slandered. And then a lot of people can become cynical. You know, a great example of this misinterpretation of God's promises is Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, which says, "Raise up a child in the way it should go, and when it is old, it'll not depart from it." And many people misinterpret that verse. They fail to understand the nature of a proverb. The Bible is true. It is all true. Whatever the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that's the end of the argument. That's the final word, the name of our program. Well, we do have to understand, however, what it is that God has promised. And the nature of a proverb is to make general observations. They happen to be inspired because they're biblical proverbs. General observations about the way things generally work in God's moral universe. Unless by the very nature of the case, they are always true. Well, it is not always true that if devout parents raise up their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, they raise them up to walk in the way they should, that when they're old, all of that will take with the kids and the kids will follow through in the same tradition of faith as their parents. What is generally true is that when believing parents take the trouble, invest the time to raise their children in the ways of the Lord, generally, those kids will follow through. I don't mean just grab your kids up and take them to church on Sunday, stick them in a youth group or in children's ministry somewhere, and there you have a guarantee they will walk in the ways of the Lord. Oh, no, no, no. I mean investment, folks. I mean investment. I mean an example. I mean teaching, the nurture and the instruction of the Lord, which so many believing parents do not do, and kids just peel off right and left. So, it's a general truth. It's not an absolute truth. So people take for a promise that which is not an axiomatic promise. And then they just assume, not that they misunderstood, but they just assume, well, that's not true. If one thing's not true, then two things probably not true, then three, and so on. And you can see where that goes. Now, we come to Genesis 31. Now, Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons. He heard them saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's. He's taken away from what belonged to our father. And that's the way he's made all this wealth. Jacob saw the attitude, the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Well, while he was observing all these things, the Lord said to Jacob in chapter 31, verse 3, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. This is 20 years later. Well, in the corridors of life, one needs always to keep one's eyes open and to keep our ears to the ground in order to detect threatening changes in the social weather, so to speak, and get prepared for the elements, as it were. Jacob, as I said, has spent 20 difficult years in Mesopotamia, the first 14 working off his bride debts, then building up his assets in his arrangement with Laban. Never had Jacob originally planned to stay that long when he showed up there in flight as a fugitive from the murderous intentions of his very angry brother Esau. However, often in life, our plans do not work out the way we envisioned. But from what Jacob was overhearing, and Jacob judging from the countenance of Laban toward him, there was legitimate reason for concern about things degrading there in Mesopotamia with the family of his two wives. It is often the case that just before the Lord prompts us to leave a situation, whether it's a job or a city or perhaps both, God often prepares us for the exit through providential circumstances that have us prepared for unexpected change. Many of you could testify to that. I certainly can throughout my long life. I remember how the Lord prepared me to go into the teaching ministry that I never expected to go into. I had never leaned toward it, though I had opportunities that early on presented themselves. It was just not my inclination, and I wound up in it 21 years. The same was true of me coming here to Oregon, to Lake Oswego, to the seminary where I taught for 11 years. Been here forever. Would never have expected to come here, never wanted in my life to come to the Northwest. Not that I detested it, I just completely out of mind. And yet, here I've been for half my life. But the Lord, in each case, with precursors, had prepared me to make those changes. Well, Laban's sons, Jacob's brothers-in-law, were involved in the family business there in Padan Aram. That was shepherding. They had taken note that no matter what deal Laban made with Jacob, I insert that Laban apparently kept renegotiating the deal time and time again, as we will see from Jacob's own mouth, Laban always seemed to his sons to come up on the short end of the stick. Through the grapevine, verse 2, Jacob had heard that they were none too happy about the fact that, quote, Jacob has taken everything our father owned, and the guys gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father. Well, that rumor was unsettling to Jacob. Then, too, Jacob, the text tells us, noticed that Laban's attitude, meaning his countenance, toward him was not as before. In other words, his face was not as friendly as it had been before. Well, while Jacob was processing all of this, the Lord said to Jacob, in some fashion or other, we're not told, go back now to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. I want to focus on that last part of the sentence, that promise, and I will be with you. Dear friends, when the Lord directs us to go, or to do something, or to go and do something, it is always attended by His assurance that I will be with you. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is going to be hunky-dory. It didn't mean that in the case of Jacob's flight. But it does mean that God is with us, and that's all we need to know. Jacob's journey is going to be attended, for example, by some very tense moments, not to mention just the natural difficulty of moving all of his flocks and herds and other possessions and a family a distance of well over 500 miles, maybe upward to 600, depending on where they land. Then, too, Jacob could expect Laban to react none too favorably by his midnight exodus, as it were. And he had to be concerned about what would come of all that. Despite all the dangers foreseen and unseen, the point is Jacob could leave with confidence. Why? Because the Lord had told him, had promised him, I will be with you. In short, dear friends, that promise says to Jacob, or John Doe, or Mary Doe, as I have said, I have you covered. Do as I say. Once we know we have God's direction, that's key, we can always proceed in the confidence of His protection. Just be sure, however, that it is His direction and not your own predilection that you have made out to be His direction. That happens a lot. It happens a lot when we believers are over-anxious to do this or that, or to go here or there. We have an amazing way of finding a path to rationalize whatever it is we want to do, or wherever it is we want to go, or whatever it is we want to buy, by rationalizing it as God's direction, when really it is only in our own imagination. I said I see that a lot. Let me emphasize that again. It is once we know we have God's direction, then and only then can we proceed in the confidence of His protection, but be very, very sure it is His direction and not your own predilection that you have made out to be His direction. I see people and they get their eyes on moving from point A to point B, or they have their eyes on a job, something that they want there instead of here. I see so many blunders that way. Let me tell you, if you are seriously biased in your heart in some action or in some acquisition or something like that, and you go seeking the Lord's stamp of approval, you're in a dangerous posture because of that bias, because it's very easy for you to read your own predilection as God's direction. And I see all kinds of blunders made that way. You remember in the time of Jeremiah chapter 42, these people thought for certain that the Lord would want them to go down into Egypt, and they come to Jeremiah and they say, oh, we're just ready to do whatever the Lord says. You take time, you pray, and you come back and tell us. And when Jeremiah came back and said, the Lord does not want you to go to Egypt, you'll be in big trouble if you go, you're a liar, the Lord did not tell you that. Well, that scene is, in principle, is played over and over again by believing people who have their own bias about what God's will should be. Tilt the odds against yourself. That's my policy, and it works pretty well. Well, we'll come back to that thought next time. Thank you for joining us, dear friends, on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.